Good afternoon, and I want to thank all of you for coming. We're going to make a big shift from a very high-risk population of sex workers in South Africa to all of Uganda. I'll be talking about the generalized epidemic that took place in Uganda. I have no relationships to disclose. So if you look at Uganda, these are HIV prevalence rates in the early 1980s, late 1980s and early 1990s. And these are all based upon all the women who came to clinics for prenatal care. And the top blue line right there, that's all who came to a particular clinic in Kampala, which is the capital of Uganda. And you can see that in 1985, 10% of them were HIV positive, and in just a small number of years, that 10% shot up to 30%. So there was an explosive increase and an explosive spread of HIV. If we shift from the capital to the next four largest towns or cities, we see that there was also a very large and rapid increase from about 13% up to 20%. In the rural areas, the rates were much lower, but they were also growing rapidly. This was an absolutely dismal situation. The projections were absolutely terrible. People envisioned huge proportions of the population dying. And then look what happened. There was an absolutely dramatic decrease. Not down far enough, but still dramatic. The lines represent different groups. The dark blue line still represents the same clinic that we saw here, and you see it declines very rapidly. This violet line represents a different clinic in the capital as well. This represents the four largest cities, and this represents, again, the rural areas. And what you see is that in both Kampala, the capital, and the next four largest towns or cities, it all peaked in 1992 and then began coming down dramatically. And in the rural areas, it peaked a couple years later and came down not so quite so dramatically, but still a lot. So this raises the question about why did it come down? And some people like to look at Uganda and say the answer is simple, and they'll come up with their favorite answers to why. The reality is what happened in Uganda is really quite complex. There are no simple answers. There are a variety of relatively small changes that took place, small in terms of their overall impact on HIV prevalence. There were improvements in the blood supply. There were improvements in the use of clean needles. There was less sharing of knives during traditional male circumcision ceremonies. And of course, if you can imagine cutting off the foreskin on a penis and doing that repeatedly without cleaning it, if any of the males had been already infected, then that could just spread to the other males. But most important were not those changes. Most important, there were changes in sexual behavior. That raises the question, well, what can we conclude about the changes in sexual behavior? And I can assure you, this is an enormously controversial topic, just enormously controversial. And there are many conflicting claims. And it's also a very important topic because billions, literally billions of PEPFAR dollars have been spent on particular kinds of programs. Throughout the entire world, money is being spent, let me say it slightly differently. One claim is it came down because people abstained from sex. And they place a huge emphasis on the role of abstinence in the decline in Uganda. And as a result of that, billions have been spent on abstinence programs in Africa, and there's an effort throughout the entire world, Latin America, all over, to increase abstinence programs, and they often cite this success in Uganda. On the opposite side, there are people who say, no, greater condom use. But there hasn't been a lot of evidence for that. So that has not been a real strong claim. There are other people who say, no, it's because women were empowered, or a variety of other things happened. What really happened? What I'm going to do is try to answer that question. And I'm going to try to answer it more definitively than people have in the past. And I'm applying or using a different approach than many people have in the past. Instead of looking at just one or two types of evidence, what I've done is to look at seven different kinds of evidence. And you can just kind of see what they are. They're models, reports of behavior change, large surveys, smaller surveys, reports of numbers of condoms, and historical documents. And I'm now going to go through each one of those very quickly. Starting with the model, the yellow line is the actual prevalence that you saw before. The violet line is now the calculated prevalence designed to estimate the actual prevalence as close as possible. And we did this simply by making various assumptions about deaths, et cetera, and then plugging in numbers for incidents so that we would produce a prevalence that matched the actual prevalence as closely as possible. So nothing real sophisticated about this, just simple dynamics. And what you can see is that one of the models that fits the best is a model in which increases rather rapidly until 1987. And it peaks at that time, and then it begins to decline. Where did my cursor? There it is. Begins to decline, and then incidence declines very rapidly in 1993. It's very difficult to replicate the actual prevalence curves without both there being a peak somewhere in here, maybe not exactly 1987, might be 1988, but somewhere right around in here, and then a second very sharp decline in here. It's just not possible without both of those to well reproduce the actual prevalence rates. So it indicates quite strongly that something was happening in 87. What was that something? To find out what was that something, we looked at newspaper reports of behavior. We looked through literally every single issue of the primary newspaper in Uganda, which is called The New Vision. And we then photocopied those studies, and we did this for every issue for every year for many years, and then went back and analyzed all those. What do we find? The first reports about any kind of behavior change, and also some of the first reports about HIV and AIDS itself, are these, which you see. This one occurred in October 23, 1987. The horror of SLAM, which is what they call AIDS in Uganda, is forcing people to change social habits. It is in marital relationships where one can easily detect the most profound changes. A number of wives openly go so far as to confess that SLAM has saved their marriages. And Bugalobi, a young housewife with three children, declared with a gleam in her eye, "There has been a positive change in our marriage. My husband stays at home much more, and I encourage him to do so by enthusiastically keeping him informed of the latest gossip about SLAM victims." So this is one of the first articles about behavior change. And you see it's talking about greater monogamy within the relationship. Another one in August 1987, that roughly that same period of time, same months, "It is not so good for prostitutes. SLAM, AIDS, has ruined business, irrespective of the fact that for as little as 20 shillings, one can get service. Few customers are turning up, except perhaps when drunk." A couple months later, "The tendency of male drinkers to entice barmaids into quick sexual liaisons is no longer a common occurrence." So something is happening regarding sexual behavior. People are having fewer sexual partners, less casual sex. This one is important because it's in Arua. The first few were more around Kampala. This is in a completely different part of the country. "The fear of AIDS has reportedly changed social behavior in Arua drastically. Many cinema, disco, video, hotel, and restaurant operators complain of loss of business because of poor attendance and poor turnover, because loose men and women are no longer entertaining and tolerating each other as before." Again, greater faithfulness. This is the only one that I found during this period of time and for a couple of years having to do with condoms, whereas the previous quotes were samples or examples from a much larger number, many pages of similar kinds of things. This is the only quote about condoms, and it took place in Kampala, the capital. "A better insurance than secret charms provided by traditional healers, particularly for men, is the condom. The sudden profusion of discarded condoms, which unfortunately children frequently use as toy balloons, is evidence of popular use." So this indicates that there was some condom use at that time, but for other reasons we'll see there was very little. Another type of data, this is our third type of data, is to look at survey responses about reported changes in behavior in response to HIV/AIDS. These are based on large, nationally representative surveys, but on the other hand, of course, if you ask people in a country like Uganda, which is experiencing a horrendous epidemic, if you ask them, "Have you changed your behavior as a result of AIDS, and if so, how?" you're likely to get biased responses. So I would say these are probably fairly biased. On the other hand, they provide some indication of how people changed. In Uganda, most people are married, and therefore I'm presenting their data first. They marry really quite young. Among married people, you can see 66%, or about two-thirds, this is for men, restricted sex to one partner, 5% began using condoms. So again, evidence of much greater monogamy, a little bit of evidence for condom use. Among women, similar percentages. Among never married people, there they have the option, the possibility, because they're not married, of delaying first sex or stopping sex altogether. And we see that significant percentages delayed first or stopped sex or restricted sex to one partner, Only 17% began using condoms, 3% of the women. So again, evidence that there were increases in monogamy and a little bit of condom use. Fourth kind of data. These now are data, they're not asking them how they have changed, but rather data collected in either 1988 or 1989, and then again in 1995. And we're looking at the change over time in their reported behavior in these very large national surveys. Now, these results may underestimate the actual behavior change because realize in the reports we saw, the newspaper reports, there was evidence of some behavior change as early as 1987. And data were not collected until 88 or 89. So they may underestimate a little bit the amount of behavior change. This is women, according to the DHS, the Demographic and Health Survey. This is the stronger of the two surveys. We see that 82% had sex in 1989. That decreased to 75% in 1995. Some change, a greater percentage of all women were abstaining from sex, but a fairly small change, only a change of 7 percentage points. We look at those who have never had sex, young people, we see a greater drop in the percent that had ever had sex. If we look at all those who were never married, 15 to 24, again, a drop in the percent that had sex, not ever, but in the last year. So different indicators, all indicating that there was some drop, but more among those who were single and never married. If we look at the results from the Global Program and AIDS surveys, we should remember that the comparison between the 88-89 data and the 95 data is not quite as good because the districts were not identical, so there might have been biases, and there were slight differences in the questionnaires. On the other hand, it's the only data we have for some of these other kinds of outcomes. Here, again, looking at women, we see that there, among all women, that there's a large decrease in the percent that had sex with non-marital or non-cohabitating partners. Among singles, there was a decrease in the number who had two or more partners, and the percent that had extramarital sex was low to begin with and remained low. If we now shift to men, again asking some of the same questions, we only have data for the GPA, from the GPA for men, none from the global, the Demographic and Health Survey. Small decrease in the percent that had sex last year, so abstinence did play some role, but not a very large one. A large decrease among single young people who had ever had premarital sex. We look at among all of them, those that had sex with non-marital or non-cohabitating partners declined by about half, from 41 to 21. We look at those who are single men, those who had two or more partners declined by a lot. Looked at those who are married and had extramarital sex, again declined. So again indicating that it was mostly a greater faithfulness within relationships that had the impact. Now, we're shifting here in the form of our graphs from 1 year to another year, and that's because I don't have data. There don't exist data about condom use for men for 1988 and 89. They're simply not available. What we know is that in 88 and 89, only a very small percentage, one or two or three, something like that, very small percent had used a condom. So here what we see, for all men, regardless of residence, whether or not they live in urban or rural areas, 16% had ever had sex. If we look at men, however, in urban areas, which is where the declines took place first, we see it's greater, much greater. It's 41% in rural areas, much smaller. If we shift now and look only at those men who are having sex within their marital or cohabitating relationship, what we see is that the percent that used a condom the last time they had sex is very low. Not surprising. People are not likely to use condoms with long-term marital or cohabitating partners. But now if we shift and look at those men who are having sex with non-marital or non-cohabitating partners, a much higher percentage of them had used a condom the last time they had sex with that partner. Overall, throughout the country, 36. In urban areas where it declined first, 62%. Rural areas, less. People have argued that condoms could not have played a role because there simply were not enough condoms ever shipped to Uganda in order to protect enough people. And that's a true statement if you make two incorrect assumptions. If you look at the data only for the numbers of condoms distributed through social marketing, and if you assume that all condoms are used equally across everybody throughout the country. But that's not the case. This is the same graph you saw before. I'm bringing it up just to emphasize, again, that there is a point in 87 and then this big decrease in 1992. So this should look familiar to you. It's the same graph. So think about 1992, and what you see here is a rather rapid increase in condom, the availability of condoms, the number of condoms shipped to Uganda in 1993 and in later years. This data is also a big increase, but there's some evidence to indicate that a lot of those condoms, or some of them at least, may have simply sat on a wharf somewhere in Uganda and may not have all gotten out to the people. So the bigger increase then occurred in these later years. And by 1993, 23 million condoms actually was enough condoms to protect a very large percentage of the acts of intercourse among those people who are having sex in casual relationships. So the claims that have been made before that there were not enough condoms are simply no longer correct. Though I should also point out that these numbers are much, much larger. It's the first time these have been presented, much, much larger because we did a search for all the organizations in the world. Sorry, not all of them, but many, and came up with many more condoms. So in terms of condom use then, there are really four things which suggest that condoms also played a role. Clearly monogamy did, but condoms also played a role. Is that for me? That's for me. Okay, thank you. We see that the increase in condom use coincided with sharp decrease in incidence in the early 1990s, that is in 1993, in urban areas. Condom use increased first in urban areas and then in rural areas, similar to the decrease in HIV incidence. Condom use increased most markedly among those people who had sex outside of marital and cohabitating relationships and thus might have contributed most to the sexual networks. Condom use increased most rapidly among those age groups that were most likely to become infected and among more educated and wealthier males who are particularly likely to have multiple partners. I removed those slides because of the interest of time, but there are slides substantiating that last part. If we look at then what actually happened, this is the final kind of evidence, documents describing the programmatic response. In 1986, AIDS prevention began, and they did lots and lots of things. There was presidential leadership, there was a multi-sectoral approach. All the different sectors, all the different organizations became involved over a period of time. In the beginning, without doubt, the primary emphasis was on abstaining or being faithful. There were messages sent out, you know, widely spread about zero grazing. What does zero grazing mean? If you're a farmer, you have your goat and you stake your goat and it then kind of forms a zero, you know, stays within a zero or a circle, and it doesn't go into your neighbor's backyard. Similarly, only have sex within your own backyard. Don't stray to nearby backyards. Be faithful, love carefully. Those are more clear. But the message was also, really do abstain or be faithful. That's the most important thing. But if you can't do that, then use a condom. In 1991 to 93, things began to change. There were media efforts to dispel myths about condoms and to encourage their use. There was some opposition to this, and then there was, quote, the quiet promotion of condoms. It wasn't quite so visible. There was social marketing of condoms, and the number of condoms, as we saw, greatly increased. So the greater promotion and the greater the availability of condoms then did coincide with the greater use of condoms and also with that second decline. So my conclusions, I think all seven types of data that I've presented produce a consistent picture of what happened, not inconsistent, but a consistent picture. Each of these different methods have a limitation, but the strength of one method offsets the limitations of another. For example, the newspaper reports are very good at specifying when something happened, a particular event, but they are not large surveys. They're not broadly representative. The large surveys, on the other hand, can show broad changes between different periods of time, but they can't identify exactly when those changes in behavior took place. So the methods are complementary in my mind. And the conclusions then that I reached in this, first, there was a reduction in the number of sexual partners prior to or outside of long-term relationships. That was the most important change. There was also a small increase in total abstinence, but that was small largely because most people in Uganda are married at an early age. after that reduction in numbers of sexual partners outside of relationships took place, then there was an increase in condom use with non-marital, non-cohabitating partners. So in other words, if you're familiar with A, B, and C, abstinence, be faithful, and C for condoms, A, B, and C all did change and all did contribute. But B, especially B, and also C were most important, and that's in part, as I said, because most people married young and had sex. If you think about it, this is a very powerful combination. First, in Uganda, it spread so rapidly because there were very large sexual networks with concurrent sexual partners, so it could spread very rapidly from one partner to another. By reducing the number of partners, those sexual networks broke up. They became smaller, more localized sexual networks. That shattered the great big, the very large sexual networks. And then within those smaller sexual networks, began using condoms more and reducing the chances that HIV would be transmitted. And as a result of that combination, in that order, HIV incidence then fell very dramatically. And it's possible that the same type of thing can be done elsewhere in the world. I've written much more in-depth reports, both about why, about these behaviors, and also about the various programmatic efforts that led to a change in these behaviors, and those are all available at this website. Thank you very much.